Okay, last week we did some things with regards to the Mishkan, and we looked at the Mishkan in a way that was perhaps a little bit different, and we carried the idea of the Mishkan through the idea of a visual perception of a commandment. And when we looked at that visual perception of the commandment, what we were doing was seeing, in some sense, we were seeing the mechanics of how certain commandments work. Now, the interesting thing about what we did last week and the commandment that we were discussing was to build the Mishkan and the tabernacle, of course. And that is the only commandment that is associated with construction of an object directly related to a commandment. Okay, so there is a direct commandment to build the Mishkan, and on the Rambam, his schedule or his Sefer Mitzvot, that is commandment number 20. And he tells you, of course, there, you know, to build the Mishkan. We talked about plenty of that last week, so we're not going to rehearse that really any last week. But there's a couple of things I said during Purim this week I wanted to share with this class, and then they'll probably overlap from what we did say, and then they'll probably explain a couple of other things. And then, time permitting, then what I want to do is start working on something that is basically a cosmology. And the cosmology will help us understand and explain things that are related to how we can view the cosmos. Now, when I say cosmos, I'm saying it with a K. And I make a differentiation. The K cosmos means that it covers everything. All of spirituality, all of physical mechanics, all of those particular aspects of nature, etc. But when I say cosmos with a C, I mean that which is physical. Okay? So if we talk about our universe, we can talk about it spiritually, and then that supersedes the physical, and we can take in also spiritual aspects. If we just talk about our universe and we try to bring that down to what is material, what is physical, then, you know, there's a whole differentiation between the two subjects, because, you know, we all know that at some point our natural space, if you want to use that phrase, it ends. And then somewhere the spirituality continues beyond that space and time, etc. Okay, well, we'll try to get into that just a little bit. Now, one of the things we did at Purim the other evening was we began to just discuss a couple of things. And one of the things that I think everybody here probably knows that during the time of Yeshua, what was happening in the Beit Din's at that particular time, the Sanhedrin specifically, and as far as the exact date, I don't know. I have to go search that out. But as far as being generally in the time frame of Yeshua, one of the things they were trying to determine is whether or not the Book of Esther should be a part of the canon of the Tanakh. Okay, and so everybody here probably knows perfectly that one of the reasons why they were not considering the idea that it should be a part of the Tanakh was because it didn't have the name of God. Okay, God's name wasn't directly written into the text in a way that, you know, you can read this particular verse, and then you hear, you read God, and then you know that God was involved in it. So there was that, you know, typical Sanhedrin type situation. Two Jews, three synagogues. You know, we're going to stand up and fight about whether this should go in here or shouldn't go in here, etc. And of course, it wasn't really, you know, any type of real fight. It's just, you know, that Jewish methodology of discussion and, you know, working something out. So, you know, that was their issue. But they resolved the issue based on a Bible verse in the Tanakh, or excuse me, actually in the Torah, and it is in Deuteronomy 31:18. In Deuteronomy 31:18, the context of that particular verse is Hashem being upset with the Jewish people because they have not been following his mitzvot, basically. And so he says that, you know, I'm going to hide my face from them, and that, you know, basically he's hiding his face because of their evil or their negativity, etc. But in Hebrew, what that particular verse says is Hester, H-E-S-T-E-R, and then Esther, E-S-T-H-E-R. Hester, Esther is what he said. I will hide my face from them. Okay, because of their evil, etc. Now, one of the things I started learning with His Eminence, and he bought me a book that I still haven't read through the very end of it. It's one of those things that is, you know, hardcore hermeneutics, and it has a million and one examples as to the hermeneutics, but it's not one of those 20-minute reads. If you're going to sit down and read it, you want absolute quiet, you want absolute concentration, and you want to be able to absolutely dissect what's being said. And it's going to require some mechanics in the process of following along the idea. But one of the things that this guy said is about Mishnaic Hebrew and the methodology that is used in Mishnaic Hebrew, and even what the hermeneutics that was practiced during the time of Yeshua, etc. Now, what they do is they have a text. So in this case, they have text Deuteronomy 31:18. And they say in that verse, you know, the reason they picked Esther and believed that Esther was a part of the canon of the Tanakh was because of the word Esther. And the word Esther was associated with the Torah verse, okay, again, Deuteronomy 31:18. So when that verse is cited, everyone knows that Esther means, you know, he's going to hide. It's going to be said in duplicate, or as I said the other night, and as we well know, it's like putting an exclamation point on the end of a sentence, okay? And so, you know, maybe that, if you say it like that, it's two exclamation points. I don't know. But nevertheless, the idea here is that, you know, that's what they do. Now, what they do, and this is quite a common practice, is they take a verse and then they take and totally throw away all of the context. Okay? So there, when you read this verse, there is no context. So normally what we would do in a hermeneutic process is take and read the data that we read, and then we would stop, you know, step back, look at some surrounding verses, and see what's going on. Okay, so if you did that with Deuteronomy 31, then you're going to see that God's upset with the Jewish people because of the negativity they've done, etc. So that would be its context. But when you divorce the material from the context, then what you have is something that is sort of like it's free floating in space, if you want to kind of say that. And you can use it for whatever you want to use it for. Okay. Now the rabbis do this incessantly. I mean, many times you don't realize that what they're doing is they actually have followed this process, lift it out of its context, use the words for whatever definition that you want to use, and then go on, okay? And so in this case, they use, you know, the idea that the word Esther is found in this verse and that it's associated with Hester. And so the two words, actually, they both mean the same thing, that I'm going to hide, okay? Or in this case, he says, you know, Hester Panim, my face. I'm going to hide my face, or I'm going to hide my presence, okay? Now, that being said, you know, the context for what's going on beyond that, you know, they actually can just say, we don't care whether it's talking about evil. We don't care if it's talking about good. We don't care. So we just need these two words so that they can give us a definition of what this idea means. And then they use the definition and then they go on. Okay. But when the sages were working with this passage in trying to determine whether or not Esther should be a part of the Tanakh, they kept the whole verse or the basis for the whole verse. And then they said, basically, what it reads as is that the reason that God's going to hide his face is because of the evil that is going on. Okay? Now, you have to remember now what's being said, and that is that it's associating this with the book of Esther. Okay? Everybody with me? Keep that in the forefront of your mind, because if you don't keep that in the forefront of your mind, you're going, you know, what on earth is the deal here? Okay? So, you know, they do give the reasoning. God gives the reasoning. The reason I'm going to hide is because my association finds this context of extremity of evil, and because of the extremity of evil, now I'm going to hide my face. Okay? So, everybody's got it figured out before me. I know this is how it is. It's always the way I play the game. So, you know, I'll just give you my two cents, and I know you already thought through the process. Okay, so God says, and if you apply it to the book of Esther now, he said, I'm going to hide my face. So, in the book of Esther, then what you have is that God's presence is hidden. All right, it's hidden, it's doubly hidden, so you never see God whatsoever, right? Because, you know, he's hidden his face, and why does he hide his face? Because of the extremity of the evil that is going on, in this case, not by the Jewish people so much, yeah, they got some problems, but what's going on against the Jewish people, okay? So, he hides his face, because, not because he isn't going to repair the situation or he doesn't have a solution to the situation, but what he wants to do is hide and then let it be discovered that he's been here all along and he's still doing his job no matter whether his presence is evident or whether his presidency is hidden. Okay, so you can understand now that God is saying, I'm hiding my face, and then they'll never know I was here. But eventually, of course, the evidence is going to be perfectly evident that he was here all along. Okay, so when you read that into the Esther story or Purim story, then it becomes really a powerful, powerful tool. And in that way, Purim and the book of Esther become a testimony to you and I. So, you know, every minute of the day, we're expecting God to be looking down on our circumstance and making sure that everything that happens to me is happening the way I want it to happen. Okay, and it doesn't matter what's happening to the next guy. I just want to make sure that it's happening right for me, right? Okay, so when you begin to look at this verse and the way that it comes down, then you see that, of course, God's presence is hidden, and this is where they take their hint. And so then they come and they say the Sanhedrin, the great Sanhedrin, the Sanhedrin Gadol, they say, yes, this book absolutely belongs in the Tanakh because God is evident even when he's not evident. And then sometimes he hides himself, and when he hides himself for various purposes, etc. Now, you know, when you begin to take that mindset, it really does have cosmic consequences. Okay? Now, I'm not going to get off into this too hard tonight, but I'm going to say this. In my cosmology, when I say my cosmology, it's just basically more how I can understand, you know, how God is functioning in the cosmos. Doesn't mean I'm right, doesn't mean I'm wrong, but it's my opinion. And like all of us, we have belly buttons, and so each one of us are entitled to our opinion. And so, you know, I just give mine. And, you know, if it helps you, it does. If you disagree, then it's good that you disagree, because then you can build your own opinion, okay? Now, there's a thing that is called Tsimtsum. Tsimtsum is a word I really dislike, okay? And the reason I dislike Tsimtsum is because of this. So, and we talked about it enough that you will understand, which is minimal rehearsal, that, you know, the idea of Tsimtsum is that God is going to contract himself, and he's going to contract himself in a way that makes part of himself disappear. And, you know, I kid my classes here on Sunday, and I say, you know, there we have a word for that in Hebrew, and it's called ba-lo-ni, right? Okay, so when we come to the place that we say that God is going to hide himself, you know, how in the world is God going to, you know, hide himself, or how is God going to make himself be absent from a particular area? It can't happen, right? What is one of the favorite words that we use about him? We call him the omnipresent. Or in Hebrew, we use another word. We call it makom. And makom means the place, meaning that there is no place where God is not existent. He's everywhere, okay? So when you start to, you know, use this idea of God being absent from a place, he's not actually ever absent. So weave this now back into the story of Esther. Okay, was God absent in the story of Esther? No. You know, just because you don't see him doesn't mean he wasn't there, right? You know, just because he doesn't advertise, you know, the great big S on his chest or whatever the emblem is, you know, doesn't mean that he's not evident. He's not evident because, you know, one of the things that's evident about God is he does not need any outside acclamation, like saying, "You're God, we know you're God, and, you know, if it wasn't for us, you wouldn't be God." You know what I'm saying? God is God no matter what you do, whether you're in the circumstance, out of the circumstance, or whatever the situation might be. You see what I'm saying? So one of the things that, you know, always has amazed me, or at least this particular time, it amazed me a lot, because when I'm thinking about Esther, and I did quite a bit of this here in the past a few weeks, because I was teaching a class on Romans chapter 8, and in Romans chapter 8, you know, all the criteria for Romans chapter 8, there's so much deep spirituality that's going on there that, you know, it really is mind fog to try to work your way through some of it. But one of the things that everybody tries to say, and, you know, I'm saying basically Christianity and maybe even Messianics, I don't know. I don't know Messianic theology or ideology that well. So I just know there are a bunch of rebellious people, and I try to stay away from all that, okay? So the other thing is that, you know, everybody, as soon as they start talking about, you know, spirituality and where it began and how it began and all that, one of the things they, you know, immediately do, Christians, is that they turn to the Nazarene Codicil and they say, well, it happened because of Yeshua. Well, there are certain things that did happen because of Yeshua. There's no two ways to ignore that or get away from it. But guess what? The new covenant started with Ezra and Nehemiah. What? You know, they're the ones that salvaged Judaism. If it hadn't been for what they did now, there wouldn't be any synagogue. If it hadn't been for what they did then, there wouldn't be any church. You know, so you can start put the pieces of the puzzle together and see that this is, you know, a magnanimous thing that was done. You know, them and the men of the great assembly, and, And, you know, we also discussed the minute of the Great Assembly. Some of the people, you know, a lot of people didn't really realize were a part of it. You know, Zechariah, of course, Ezra, and you've got Haggai, you've got all of these different prophets that are part of this men of the Great Assembly. And one of those guys also was a guy named Mordecai. And everybody was supposed to say, yay, right, for Purim. Okay, so when we were having Purim, we had one girl, she'd never been to Purim before. She comes in, her modus operandi is always show up late. Well, we decided to start the Purim Fest at 5 o'clock, and so we got an hour early start. She showed up 20 minutes earlier than the normal class does. She shows up and thinks she's early, and she's already late, right? And so she sits down, and every one of us, we're reading through the story of Esther by now, and, you know, we're, you know, hearing Haman, boo, you know, Esther, you know, we're going through all the stuff, and the girl is going absolutely crazy. Like, what on earth is going on with y'all, you know? So, that being said, you know, when you begin to apply this idea of Esther and Hester and all of this to Simsum, what do you come up with? You come up with the fact that God is hidden, but it's an intentional hiding. And there are several things to say about that that are things that are difficult to deal with, but that's not tonight's discussion, maybe next week or something. But in this process of reading that the Nazarene Codicil is not the beginning of the New Covenant, it is only a rehearsal of the beginning of the New Covenant, which began with Ezra and Nehemiah, okay? Now, if you were to put this whole process, Esther, Ezra, Nehemiah, and then put it into a historical context, okay? So then your question is, what happened where, what happened when, who happened, who was in this and that, and etc. And if you look at the chronology, now I've gone through some chronology of these particular dates and some things, and you might find something different. That's fine. You know, there's always, you know, a different opinion. But really, you know, when you stop and you have just got done reading Esther, and then you start to think, well, look it, here we are at the end of Esther. And then what's going to happen next? Okay? And, you know, we read and, you know, they were able to defend themselves. You know, so many people died, etc., etc. And then you say, chronology or chronologically, what's going to happen next? Well, what happens next in the chronology is Ezra and Nehemiah. Okay? So then the question is, you guys that know, hush. Okay, how long, how far in the future was it that Ezra and Nehemiah actually came on the scene? Now, before I answer the question, let's understand something. What were they doing? What did Ezra and Nehemiah do? Number one, rebuild the walls. Okay, number two, rebuild the temple. Okay, and then, of course, let's reorganize Judaism. All of these points are valid points in us understanding where we're at right now in the chronology and the time frame of what God's doing to bring the final sabbatical 1,000 years into place. I got good news for you tonight, Adon Shlomo. Maybe it'll make you happy, maybe it won't, okay? So then the question is, you know, you never can make this guy happy, you know. If you told him it's going to happen 5 years from now, he wants it in two. You know what I'm saying? So it's all right. And on that particular subject, we both are in agree. If it was yesterday, that would have been great with me too. You know what I'm saying? Okay, but here's the thing. And I'm not saying, let me put it this way. Don't put words in my mouth But you think about this yourself, okay? Now, we know that from the time of Esther, things in that kingdom changed, okay? And the changes that went on in the kingdom, you know, brought guys like Nehemiah in to be the cupbearer. You know what I mean? He's there seeing the king every day, giving him his cup of wine, making sure that he's not dead and all this kind of stuff. And the king says to him one day, he said, Nehemiah, what's wrong with you? You look so sad. What's the matter? Well, you know, we need to rebuild the temple. We need to blah, 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 you know. And so Nehemiah is giving the king, you know, the fifth degree about all the things that need to happen in Eretz Israel. So, you know, as it comes down, then we get all these decrees. Well, it should have been 70 years. 70 years has come up. The time frame, the chronology has all been excavated. Oh, man, and that is a curious idea. Anything. Anyway. Almost lost my train of thought. I'll try to hook it up in a minute. Now, the question is, again, how long from Esther to Ezra and Nehemiah? And the answer is 15 years. Okay? So now, listen to me. You can't just use 15 years because everything had to be shifting from the time of Purim. Everything had to be shifting so that what you can see is that the shift is being made from what happens in Esther in Purim and then what is starting to transact in Eretz Israel. So you could probably say that, you know, a day after, a few days, a month, whatever your number you want, that certain things started to change in Eretz Israel to turn it back towards the opening for the new covenant that was going to be initiated by Ezra and Nehemiah, okay? But Ezra and Nehemiah just didn't walk in the door and say, here we are, now we're going to bring all this change. Poof, snap our fingers, the temple's rebuilt, and the wall's rebuilt, and et cetera, et cetera. Okay? Everybody with me? So there's mechanics behind the scenes that are going on between Esther and Purim that are facilitating what's going to happen, quote, 15 years. But the 15 years doesn't really mean anything in that respect because all of the mechanics are already rolling now that you've had Purim, right? So now, when you start to think about what is happening in Ezra and Nehemiah, you understand that the spiritual mechanisms are really, really rolling in that particular era, in that particular time, okay? Now, when Ezra and Nehemiah come, number one, they rebuild, now listen to me, they rebuild the borders of Eretz Israel. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay? So they rebuild the borders, not just the walls, but in the process, they still do have what? They have conflict. You know, the Samaritans are there, right? You know the story. I don't have to tell you all about that. But it doesn't matter because what's happening to Eretz Israel in Ezra and Nehemiah's time is the re-infrastructure and building of Judaism whatsoever. Now, let me ask you a simple question. Is that what we need today? Absolutely, right? Does it need to be real reconstructed? You know, I thought one of the most profound statements of the last 50 years is when Netanyahu got up and said, listen, we don't need to listen to what the nations are telling us. We need to listen to what God is telling us. And I thought, finally, somebody has learned something. So, in my mind, I tell you what I'm seeing. Okay? Number one, you have, in some measure, a rebuilding of Eretz Israel with Ezra and Nehemiah based on the events of what happened in Purim and first of all in Shushan and, you know, the city in Babylon, etc., etc. Now, last night, it wasn't very hard for us to figure out that there is this place in the world called Babylon, and that the place where Babylon existed in antiquity was Iran. Now, that should start, you know, making the wheels turn, right? Now, there's a problem with the Esther story and today and Haman. I can't hear you guys. You're supposed to go, yeah, boo! Okay. And what is the problem? The problem is that for us to have participated in this particular Purim, is Haman's already dead. Okay? So what that tells us, good news, Ron Shlomo, we're ahead of prophecy. Okay? So you can speed up your time clock and things are moving in a direction that are faster than what we might have thought. So maybe waiting for 10 or 15 years might sound almost, you know, I could make that. Or, you know, maybe you're saying, no, I want it faster than that, etc. And in this particular set, when we're looking at this situation, what we're doing is we're looking at the fact that things are already accelerated. Okay? And that doesn't mean that we can just sit here and say, no more problems. Let's bulldoze straight forward and everything's going to be roses and etc. But there were situations that had to be dealt with in Eretz Israel in Ezra and Nehemiah's time. But one of the beauties of the whole process was that what was going on in Eretz Israel at that time was the whole reconstruction of Judaism on the whole. Now, never before have we seen situations like we are seeing in Eretz Israel today. You know, it seemed quite crazy when the Gaza thing went on. And, you know, the day before, everybody was trying to kill the guy that was a ultra-Orthodox guy there trying to pray. And they wanted to stone him in Tel Aviv because, you know, he's trying to do something that is opposite to the genre of the most advanced city in the world, Tel Aviv. But the very next day, after the situation began in Gaza, everybody was trying to get with the Orthodox guy, you know, pray so that, you know, they could put an end to everything. Okay? But in this process, also, you know, I don't know where everything's going to go in Gaza tomorrow. I don't know where everything's going to go in the West Bank tomorrow. But it's interesting that the Jews are already deciding and have intended, you know, to keep the occupation in Gaza and not let the occupation of Arabs continue there. Now, I don't know what will or won't happen. I'm not going to try to prophesy that. But here we are again with the fact that the borders have to be strengthened. And I said this last night, you know, it's interesting that in the Six-Day War, I believe it is, it may have been Yom Kippur, but I think it was a Six-Day War, when they had recaptured the Temple Mount and they had chased, you know, the Arabs from all directions, we actually, or the Jewish people, actually went all the way to Damascus, which in antiquity was a part of Eretz Israel. Okay? And of course, we know just simply by reading the Torah and having recently read a particular parts of the Torah, we know that there was a Transjordan Eretz Israel, right? Okay? So many of these things are things that, you know, I see that could be changed. Now, I'm going to tell you one little story that I just thought of a minute ago and why I had my aha moment. And I don't know, I have to look at the numbers. Some of you mathematicians can figure this out before me. When they came and they had finally taken back the temple area, temple grounds, if you want to say temple complex, the area where the temple, you know, would stand, they had run all of the Arabs out of the place. The Jews that came there were only looking to go to the west wall so they could pray at the west wall. Okay, now they, up until recently, which we've just seen recently, where the Jews decided to go there and pray. Everybody know what I'm talking about? Okay, so up until recently, they had no, they were actually, by the rabbinate, they were forbidden to go across the top of the temple platform. And that is because they didn't know where the temple had actually sat. And they didn't know where the Kodesh Kodeshim, or the Holy of Holies, was. And so they wouldn't allow them to go across there. But the soldiers were lost. When they were going back into, and when they had taken back the temple platform, they were lost. They didn't know where they were at. And all they were trying to find was the Western Wall. Because they have a tradition, we have a tradition, that the Shekinah rests at the Western Wall. And so all they were trying to do was get to the Western Wall so that they could pray at the Western Wall. That being said, they ran right straight across the temple platform and areas that they weren't supposed to be walking in, etc., etc. So that was the case. Now, all of you, I'm sure, remember the story. When they had taken back the platform of the temple, they owned it. They didn't have to do anything. They owned it. They didn't have to, you know, say anything. They didn't have to apologize to the Arabs. They didn't have to apologize to anyone. But they turned around at that particular time and gave that property back to the Arabs. Now, that happened back in, what, 67 or something like that? Somewhere around then. And that being said, and I'm guessing, I don't remember the date exactly. Somebody can look at it and figure it out and whatever. But nevertheless, the thing was, they gave it back. Now, some of you, I'm sure, and most of you probably know who Vindel Jones was. Vindel Jones was publishing a paper at that particular time. I was on his mailing list. Used to have stacks of those papers, you know, up to my eyeballs and stuff like that. Read them every week and or every month, whatever they came out. And then he started doing it electronically, etc. But nevertheless, he said at that particular time that what happened was because we had rejected, you know, taking full control over the Temple Mount, that we were exiled from the Temple Mount in such a way that meant that what we had to do was wait another 40 years before we could go back. But, you know, when did, you know, count the years, you can count if you add 70 to that, how many years would that be? Somebody figure that out. So if we added that time and we started to look at that time, you know, you could put that math together, and maybe that math, I don't know if it will or won't. I didn't think about this till just a few minutes ago, but nevertheless, maybe that math will show you that, you know, we're getting closer than we suspect with regards to many of the things that are going on. But nevertheless, we're destined to live by our mistakes. And so they did this. But now, again, back to Israel and what's going on. I think that you can see that there is a restructuring of the borders. And I think that you can also see that there is a restructuring of Judaism in how it's practiced, how it's lived, and how that people that were anti-Semitic, Jews that were anti-Semitic and, you know, anti-Torah, are beginning to receive that particular action or that awareness of the fact that, you know, if we want this land and if we want this to be our property, then we have to do what the property wants. Now, all of you are aware of the Samaritans and what the Samaritans did. Now, there was, during the time of the Maccabeans, there was an assault on the Samaritans. And the assault that was done against them destroyed their temple. And they did have a temple of their own. It has not existed since the Maccabean period. Now, they still live in the same area. I've been there two or three times. And they do every year still have a Passover sacrifice. But they do not keep the Passover sacrifice at the same time as the Jews. Okay? It's at a different time. Now, the reason why this is somewhat relevant is because the Samaritans are kind of two-faced. Number one, you know, whatever power is in power is who they're going to side with. And so what has happened in this situation is that the Maccabeans came and they destroyed the temple and they their temple. Now, I think that basically will turn out to be one of the things that will eventually come. The Samaritans will probably be driven out of the land. But that is an issue that has to do with a lot of other things and not tonight's discussion, okay? So, to kind of begin to try to wrap it up, the whole point of what I'm seeing is that, you know, here we are at Purim. Some of the things that we needed from Purim would to happen at Purim have happened before Purim, just before Purim, but nevertheless have happened. And now, you know, some of the people that that, you know, had been the Haman of the day are gone. Somebody said, well, what about his son? I said, oh yeah, that looks like a pretty good occupation. I think I'll take that, right? You know, the next thing you know, you're going to be what? You know, they're going to be bombing all around you. Who wants to play that game? So I don't know how that's all going to play out. I'm not really here to say that I know anything other than I've seen some of these signs, and I've seen the way that some of this begins to line up with how God is, you know, trying to accomplish whatever in the world today. Now, to move forward just a little bit back to the Deuteronomy 31:18 idea and my cosmology idea, is that there is one thing that, or two things actually, about the Hester, Esther, that I find difficult. And number one, all of us know that in order for us to possess free will, we have to have a certain measure of concealment, okay? God's concealment. So God can conceal himself in such a way that we don't see him, but we can have what we can say is free will. But the enemy, the Nechash, or however you want to say it, the adversary, Satan, whatever, when he comes along, as I said, there's nothing new with him. He has no new ideas whatsoever. Nothing. Okay? All he can do is what he has seen done. Okay? So God says, I have to hide my presence so that people or humanity can have free will. And then the Nechash comes along and says, sounds like a good idea to me. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to cover the covering of God. Okay? So if God is hidden so that they can have free will, God can be hidden so they can have any negativity or any negative practice they want. You see what I'm saying? And then once they can have any negative practice they want, they can do whatever they want and they can do whatever, okay? And then this, in my opinion, comes back to the other major thing that we think about at this particular time, and that is what? The Amalek, okay? And the destruction of the Amalek, okay? So, yeah, it says remember what the Amalek did. And you can talk about what happened when they were coming from the wilderness into Eretz Israel, if you want to do that. But you can also then go to Baalim and what happened there. And then you can go through history and you can find out what the Amalek have done. And one of the ways that Rabbi Akiva Tatz explains this is he said that the mindset of the Amalek is to change the word Amalek into a compound word that's part Greek and part Hebrew. And if you do that, you have A, as in if you said atheist, right, would be somebody without God or somebody who is opposed to God, an atheist, okay? And he said, but if you change it and you say Melech, then you have A, and then the word Melech, and the word Melech means king. So they reject the kingship of God, and when they reject the kingship of God, then they're literally saying, there is no God, okay? And so this is what's bled into a society today, ever since, you know, we started dealing with, you know, evolution story and things like that. Not that there's not important, you know, things of interest in and, you know, ideologies in some of the ideas that have been covered by science. But when you make the science become atheistic, then you're treading on dangerous ground. OK, and I'm not against science, so don't think that. But I am against atheism in science and that type of a thing. But Rabbi Akiva Tatz comes to the place that what he says is that, you know, they say there's no king. And I think it's in Exodus somewhere. I don't know the verse off at the top of my head. But it talks about the Amalek. And then in the same phrase, you have to read it in a Hebrew version. You cannot read it in English. It says there's a hand against the throne. And it's talking about the hand against God's throne and how that the Amalek are against God's throne. Okay? So now to bring this back into the whole satanic type situation or the Nakash or whatever, you know, he thinks that, you know, since God wants to be hidden, we'll just hide him more. And this will cause people to not be aware of his presence. And then people will act in whatever frame or conduit of life that they choose to live by. And of course, for us, that becomes a great deterrent to spirituality, to Christianity, not Christianity, but Judaism and, you know, true authentic spirituality. Okay, but then to try to, you know, sum this up back to the concealment idea is that God says, you know, I'm going to conceal my presence. And then in the Esther story, it's I'm going to hide. And in some sense, we still see that a little bit in the reflection of how the world conducts itself today. You know, God's saying, I'm going to hide. And the reason he's hiding is because of the nature of evil in the world. But nevertheless, just because, you know, we don't see him often in this way that we want to see him does not mean that he's not present. But there's another thing about concealment that is something that perhaps you haven't thought of, perhaps you haven't discussed or even heard of, and that is, you know, back to this idea that the Nakash hides the divine presence. When he hides the divine presence, it makes sin possible, okay? Because we don't think of the fact that it is sin to do something that is contrary to the will of God. But every one of us here have probably experienced in some measure or form an awareness or a revelation of God. Whether you want to call it a spiritual awakening and how many of those you might have had, or whether you just call it a spiritual awakening, and it is, you know, some revelation knowledge you had or whatever. But in every one of those circumstances where you've had those aha moments or whatever, you know that what you actually did was draw closer to God. Why? Because a piece of that veil was removed, and you could see a little bit more of God than you had ever seen before. Whatever that spiritual nugget was, it gave you a revelation. Now, when you weigh the fact that you can receive this spiritual awareness about God's presence, his character, his whatever it might be, just some spiritual truth, okay? Whenever you put that into the play, and then you know that if what you do is something negative, that you're going to put a barrier between you and God, what do you have to struggle with? My point is this, you know, if you have a revelation of God, and that's something dear to your heart, you want more of it, right? And so the more that you want is the more that you want to pull away from the side of negativity, okay? So when the side of negativity comes, now it's like having a choice. And the choice is, do you want the negativity because it's a moment of physical pleasure or whatever, however that might work out? Or do you want to keep moving toward God? Because if you do the negativity, you're going to put that barrier back in place, and you're not going to be able to have the free-flowing revelation that you had. You're going to have to fight to regain the ground, etc., etc. But if you say no to the negativity, then you have that edge to draw closer to God and closer to God. And the more you draw closer to God and the less concealment there is between you and God, the less negativity that comes out in your life. You see what I'm saying? Now, I'm not saying anyone here is in this drastic negativity of life. I'm just saying that's the mechanics of the situation, you know? And even if the world got the taste of God that you had, what would happen to the world? You see what I'm saying? Just the taste that you know of and the things that you hold dear, you know, what would happen? So this idea of Esther, and this deep concealment, you know, is something that I would say if I had a prayer and I could get my way with God is, God, would you please get rid of that or some of it or a little bit more of it so your presence can be revealed? And the presence that you have revealed, let it, you know, be a constant awareness in our mind of what's going on. Now, one thing I did, I don't know if it was this Sunday or last Sunday now. All of my Sundays and Thursdays run together sometimes. But I told the people about the worlds. We're talking about the spiritual worlds, okay? Now, one of the things that Kesson says, and I hadn't given it much thought until recently, but I started to see it in some of the vocabulary that I'm using to work on this cosmology thing, but it really was even before that. But nevertheless, there is this idea that what's going to happen to the realm of Asaya, the world that we live in, is it's going to elevate. Okay. Now, according to Kesson, and I have to go back and listen to this, but nevertheless, what he says is basically what's going to happen is the world of Asaya is going to elevate, and it's almost going to elevate to the level of Yetzirah. Okay? Now, that means that what's happening spiritually is the chain is causing the worlds to elevate in this fashion. But then there's another idea in this process. It's never just that we're beginning to move up. It is also that the upper realms above are starting to come down. Now, when the upper realms come down and all of these will converge somewhere, I think in the middle, maybe whoever knows, whatever, you know what I'm saying? Because you don't know. But, you know, the middle, if everything converged in the middle, then you would be around the realm of Birria, okay? And Birria is a very, very interesting realm. Not tonight's discussion, but it's a very interesting realm. And what it has to say and what we have to say about it is that, you know, once we begin to merge with that particular realm, and we can do part of that to this day. We can have a touch of that particular world, and the touch that we have of that world is something that is hard for most people to totally realize and understand. It's hard enough just to realize the realm that's above us in spirituality that we call Yetzirah. And Yetzirah means formation or forming. And so that means that it's the spiritual form for everything that's below. But when you go into that realm, if you were to look at the elements that are in that world, they're far more, let me say it like this, because I have no better way of saying it. Either it's holographic or it's translucent. Okay, so we don't have a solid form in the way that we have in this realm. And then it even gets worse when you go to Birria. Well, not tonight's discussion, but here's the bottom line. You know, what we are actually looking for is for these worlds to actually come together. And so that means two things. Number one, we have to get rid of our concealment of God. What I'm saying is, put your face in the book and read until you get tired of reading, and then read some more. And then the other thing is that God has promised in a certain sense that he will always match more or less our level of spirituality by his descent toward us. And in my final words, I will say, you know, this reminds me of a verse in the book of Revelation. And it says, I saw the new Jerusalem coming down out of the heavens, out of the spiritual worlds above. So for us, we have to get rid of the concealment. Hester Esther is to get rid of our ignorance of God. And then number two, you know, to do everything that we can to draw the divine presence back down into the realm that we live in, but also to carry the world with us upwards, etc., etc. End of my rant. Questions or comments?
It's very apropos study for the times we're in now, and just the, you know, and like I said, who needs a newspaper? Who needs the news?
Yeah.
Reading and studying the right thing at the right time.
That's exactly right.
It makes so much sense. When you see it, it's like extra clear. The world's seeing the same thing we are.
Yeah, yeah.
They're seeing it on a nephesh level, if you will, at the most.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and yeah, very good. Very good, Jeremy. It's
Torah Rabbah. Well, you know, it's very much one of the things that I used to say to people is that, you know, when you know that God is going to do whatever God is going to do, stop looking at the Gregorian calendar and look at, you know, I say quit looking at the calendar on your refrigerator and start looking at, you know, time as it's laid out in the Tanakh. And then when you begin to see it from that perspective, then, you know, it's like when 9/11 happened. I know it was a tremendously tragic event, but, you know, everybody was like, the world's going to end, everything's just changed. And I said, yeah, they missed it by a couple of days. You know what I mean? Because it wasn't Rosh Hashanah. If it happened on Rosh Hashanah, I would really be concerned. You see what I'm saying? But it didn't. So, but it, I think it's very interesting. Not that I know anything about anything, but those were the things I thought I found interesting. And it was all God that showed it to me, I believe. So, anyone else?
Ezra Nehemiah, I think we've seen some 15 years. That's 15 years from then. That's what you were talking about, looking in verse 2.
It's from the time of Purim to the time of Ezra and Nehemiah going into Jerusalem was about 15 years. That's about 15 years, yeah. But of course, you know that there's all the background things that are going on, the infrastructure. You know, so for example, you could take, like, you know, when we started the, we were in the Iraqi war there. You know, we didn't, my brother-in-law, he went, and when he told me, he told me, he said, don't worry about it, it's not going to happen until this date, and it was the exact date, and no one told him the date, you know what I mean? He wasn't one of those guys in the upper echelons, no, it's just military, and he understood the infrastructure of what would happen. You need the infrastructure behind you before you do this, and then you need these conditions with the moon, the sun, et cetera, to happen so that we can accomplish this. And he was exactly right on target. So that being said, you know, you have a lot of infrastructure there that is being built in the meantime. So I don't know what all that means for right now for us, but I think there's a lot of infrastructure going on that we may not see. I don't show almost something's wrong with your microphone. I can't hardly understand what you're saying.
Sorry, I turned it off. I guess when I was speaking, that is good news for me. What's the good news?
Oh, the good news was it may not be next life, it's this life in maybe 5, 10, 15 years.
Oh, okay. Just before class, I haven't had time to listen to it. Well, my listeners, Jeff, behind Jeff, sent out a 15-20 minute teaching where he said that Edom was going to destroy and defeat Iran, and then Messiah would come back later. So I've heard about that,
but I have not listened to it either. But and I think we're talking about the same person. But I've heard something about that. But so if they said that, then Edom would, in my opinion, would rather refer to the United States rather than specifically Christianity, is what I would take.
And so, looking at the calendar, that would put me down.
Can't hear nothing.
But if I'm not mistaken, Ron had said that Messiah will show up at the end of the Sukkot festival. It should be answered with that. So, that's pretty close, 9 months.
Yeah.
Is anybody else having a hard time hearing?
Yeah, so much
feedback. I don't know if your mic's up too much and your speakers are playing back in, or if Adon Shlomo, because I've missed the whole conversation pretty much.
Speaker down.
We still can't hear.
Okay.
Yeah, sometimes it can do that if your microphone is behind your speakers. If your microphone is behind the speakers, it's picking up the speakers as well, and you'll have a overload in your process. But if they, you know, if we're looking at, you know, just this particular time and it being, you know, Sukkot, Shemini Atzeret, whatever, you know, my particular perspective based on the triennial schedule would be, you know, if that were correct, then the triennial schedule is off. Or if the triennial schedule is off, then it would be something that would happen not at Shemini Atzeret, but at the end of the that particular cycle. This septennate is what I would say. But that doesn't mean anything. That does not mean I'm right. That just is my perspective. So that's all I say there. Because if the septennate is right and we're on the right target, then, you know, they have said, or I have heard it said, that this septennate won't end before that happens. And if that really is true, then how the next phase begins would be the primary teaching we would need to involve ourselves in, huh?
Right.
So, very good.
I just have an input about it. Is that okay?
A little, not a lot.
Huh. All right.
You'll figure it out. You'll get it figured out. Okay, everybody good? Any other questions or comments? No? Okay. All right. You're most welcome. We'll see you guys next week. You guys have a wonderful Shabbat. Hey, keep your spiritual clothes on. We don't know what time it is we're going to leave.
Hey, we got to remember to set our...
Yeah, don't forget to reset your clock. I wonder who came up with that maniacal idea, huh?
Yeah, so like a human yo-yo.
Yeah, exactly. Shalom, shalom, everyone. Shabbat shalom.
Thank you for a great class, Rabbi.
You're most welcome.